Was ist gut? Ein Podcast des Deutschen Designer Club.
Designer arbeiten in Flüchtlingslagern oder in Kriegsgebieten mit Laptop und Akkuschrauber. Sie reden mit Händen und Füßen, wie etwa der Humanitarian Designer Thomas Jäger, einer unserer früheren Studiogäste und DDC-Mitglied. Wir spüren, dass im Social Design etwas Neues entsteht, etwas Wichtiges, etwas Übernationales und weltweit Bedeutendes. Etwas, das wir mit den klassischen Sichtweisen des Design nur schwer fassen können. Willkommen im DDCast. Mein Name ist Rainer Gerusch. In der letzten Sendung sprachen wir mit Philipp Langbach von der Umweltbank darüber, wie es möglich ist, wirklich nachhaltige Projekte zu finanzieren, welche Kalkulationen dem zugrunde liegen, welche Kriterien für Investments angesetzt werden, um herauszubekommen, ob ein Projekt tatsächlich nachhaltig ist und das Geld der Kunden den Versprechen gemäß eingesetzt wird. Heute sprechen wir mit Mariana Amatolo, ebenfalls über Messbarkeit, darüber, wie man im Social Design den Erfolg eines Projekts messen kann. Mariana ist gewissermaßen die Grande Dame des Social Design. Sie beschäftigt sich bereits seit 20 Jahren auf internationalem Niveau mit unzähligen Social Design Projekten in Slums, in Favelas, in heruntergekommenen Nachbarschaften. Aber Mariana verhandelt eben auch in den Konferenzräumen der UN oder der UNESCO darüber, wie man den Nutzen von Social Design messen kann. Nur so ist es möglich, dass Organisationen wie die UN oder auch die EU bereit sind, substanziell in Social Design Interventionen zu investieren, um mit diesen Mitteln unser Zusammenleben zu verbessern. In dieser Rolle ist sie zur Chefdiplomatin des Design geworden. Neben vielen anderen verantwortlichen Tätigkeiten ist die vielfach geehrte Mariana Amatolo derzeit Präsidentin von Cumulus, der weltweiten Vereinigung von Hochschulen und Universitäten für Design, Kunst und Medien, und sie lehrt als außerordentliche Professorin für strategisches Design und Management an der Parsons School of Design, New York. Mein Kollege Georg Christoph Bert spricht mit Mariana über Messbarkeit von Wirkung, über ihre Kindheit in den Büroräumen der UN und über die Relevanz des Social Design in Kriegszeiten.
Mariana, we should have been talking years ago, but now we finally make it. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you today.
As you are a kind of a globetrotter, where are you right now? And what do you see if you look out of the window?
Yes, I'm in New York City, which is my hometown and has been my hometown now for 5 years. I'm looking at a very rainy day, spring day here in New York.
So water is another issue we might touch later.
That's right.
But first of all, very tragic circumstances. This is the Ukrainian war, the Russian aggression against Ukraine, more precisely pronounced. And looking at this humanitarian design topics as a subsegment of social design, what are the major issues of humanitarian design in a context like, let's say, the besieged city of Mariupol?
Yes. Well, you know, it's very present, the tragedy of this invasion and of the human life loss and the atrocities that we're seeing happen in the media every day, right? I have, given the work I do, both, you know, at the New School and at Parsons, but also serving on the board of Aalto University and serving for Cumulus as its current president, I am in touch with many colleagues in Europe and have a really sort of immediate sense of the impact this is having for our concept of geopolitical order and collaboration across borders. So it's profoundly, profoundly disruptive and tragic. When I think about humanitarian design and moments of war, you know, it's interesting here in the United States, Smithsonian design, National Design Museum, the Cooper Hewitt, is coming up this later this spring with an exhibition on design for peace. And as I was thinking about this latest tragedy, it will be really, you know, interesting work that I've done with students and a faculty of Art Center College of Design many years ago is included in this exhibition. So this is why I'm tracking when it opens as well. But there is, I think, a very important role of design in these moments of war. One, of course, is in the area of communication design and how do you ensure that the the messages we have around what's happening, that there's visibility, that there is a sense of activism that gets really coordinated and reaches those all of us that can help in depending on our roles, right? There is an aspect of humanitarian design in situations that is a lot connected to logistics, to services, and reaching folks with immediate crisis response goods and services. But in the area of communication design and transparency and systems, I think about these communications, I think design can play a key role. And in this moment of live data, you know, how do you use live data to communicate and get whatever message or good to people that are stranded or needing this help. So there's many applications we're seeing and that I've seen from my work with UNICEF over the years in humanitarian crises.
So together with Brian Boyer, Jennifer May and Rochia, you are the editor of an opus magnum, as I would call it, which is called Design for Social Innovation, Case Studies from Around the World. It was published in January of this year. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank but you.
What is this book about for those who haven't heard about it?
Yes. So it's in a nutshell, it's really an overview of with 45 projects, case studies, looking at how designers are practicing in this field, in this emerging and evolving and growing field of design for social innovation. So we have invited, collected, researched projects from around the world, really touching many, many disciplines from service design to industrial design, to communication design, and in areas that span international development, public sector, private sector, and wanted to have a snapshot of how this group of designers around the world are doing this work, and that can look, you know, very different depending on where you are. And the book also includes what we call roundtables, so conversations that we curated with a team that try to really zero in on some themes that emerge from these case studies.
So we will touch the topic of diplomacy a little later. But for those who are not acquainted with diplomatic terms, doyen, or the female term la doyenne, is the longest serving diplomatic representative and usually a spokeswoman. So may I dare to call you la doyenne of social design, as you have been working in the field for quite a while?
Well, that is an honor. Thank you. My dad, who passed away just a month ago, would have been very proud. Thank you for that. He was a diplomat and a career diplomat and a long-serving ambassador. So I love that.
Thank you very much. So you did your PhD, your doctoral work in management and organizational systems. There you looked at design metrics. Let's talk a little bit about the metrics. It is an aspect, very dry aspect, often neglected when it comes to the measurement of outcome, the measurement of success, the measurement of achievements in social design projects. So let's talk a little bit about metrics and how important they are and how you look at them.
Yes, measuring value and this question of measurement is something that, of course, in the design fields, we take a very qualitative approach, iterative approach to creating tools to understand what we're doing and getting feedback loops and, you know, iterating again when we're developing products and whatever we may be doing and intervening on. For me, metrics become important because we are in a world of data, and we're also in a world that has a bias towards quantitative data and wanting to believe numbers as a more rational sort of setting to aggregate data, to correlate data, and to be able to predict and have a sense of planning, right? This is key to what we do in management, in the management field, in the social sciences. We're evaluating, we're trying to always sort of have a sense of anticipation for what might come next and how we can make decisions that are sound. So metrics and data matters. But we also need, I think, you know, the design approach to understanding numbers and understanding that actually numbers are, and data, and quantitative data, especially in all of the modeling we have with the software tools in quantitative analysis, can bring, of course, can tell different stories, right? And there's a big discussion in academia around bias, right, and what's happening with the kinds of automated tools we have, and whose stories and whose data are they showing. So these have been concerns of mine for a long time. I would say that working on, you know, on the ground with designers and the next generation of designers and students, when I was running a program I co-founded for and spent 17 years with Design Matters at Art Center, I was in a position where I was always needing to argue for the value of design. Please include, I was knocking on the doors of the UN and nonprofits and government agencies and saying, we have a creative community. How can you engage them in your projects? And so I needed sound arguments to get the funding and to get that engagement and that buy-in. And over time, I felt that it was really important to educate myself with the language and the tools of the people that I needed to work with. So the management PhD for me became a way into really learning quantitative analysis and being able to start thinking about how do we isolate and start demonstrating that designers indeed can contribute to innovation, to social innovation, to team learning, and different aspects of moving the needle when we want to make a difference. So it's been really exciting to work with the researchers at Case Western Reserve University, my former mentor, Kalli Littinen, who's an information systems scholar from Finland, and other colleagues that are statisticians. And you know, we continue working around studies that look at the metrics and the measure of design's value.
So this is, let's say rather formal side. You said that you use mm-hmm. these metrics in your communication with funders, for example, in international organizations. But if you look at the other side, talking about success of social design interventions. Mm-hmm. Social systems are dynamic in themselves, and they change while you interact with them. So dealing with metrics in social situations has always been kind of tricky, as all sociologists know.
Yes.
But let's talk about success in social design. So what?
Yes.
How do you measure, let's say, getting a little bit away from the metrics,
yes,
but rather on social impact?
Yes.
How do you kind of measure this success?
Yes. It's a great, question, because, and it's one of the actually themes in our book with Brian, Andrew, and Jennifer. We have a whole discussion that looks at how this is happening in practice. And a lot of the diagrams, these flower diagrams that are part of the book, are visualizations with a team of 2Point.Nets, our designers for this book, that have isolated a lot of the data from the surveys we collected before we chose these 45 projects. So we try to look at questions of team size in a project, funding in a project, for example, were we actually asked design teams, what were you using to evaluate your success? You know, how do you talk about success? And what was really interesting across the 45 projects is that there's a lot of use of quantitative surveys and different, you know, formal surveys that designers are actually deploying in the field. And this is a little bit counterintuitive, I would say, because we have this sense that, you know, designers are actually not measuring what they're doing. But increasingly in these projects that are very successful and in design consultancies and designers that are working with government, for example, they are very aware that they have to, consult and contribute, work with other colleagues, setting up tools. And what's one of the difficulties, one of the ongoing difficulties, is not only handling, you know, the expense of handling these, doing these reviews and these reports, but it's the sort of misalignment that we typically have between designing something and running a project and then the time it takes to understand implementation and the success of that implementation. And I always say that implementation is one of the wicked problems of design for social innovation, because typically designers are no longer involved after they created the thing or the service or whatever it might be, right? So that continues to be a real barrier, I would say.
Mm. So to take this a little further even, if you look at the world around us, we are dealing with a lot of non-linear, paradoxical, and asynchronic developments. So if you want to cope with that complexity, methodology is quite a challenge, isn't it?
I think it is. But what is also interesting is there the agency and the power of design. And what I would say there is that we are learning in complexity and in situations like the COVID pandemic that we are still, you know, not completely off, almost of, you know, all this time, more than 2.5 years later, not completely out of. We're learning that prediction and linearity does not work, right? We were in a situation with a global pandemic where there was no playbook to respond. We had to sort of jump in, dive in, and then iterate and learn through it. And designers, you know, and this is shown in my research around design attitude and metrics, designers really have, they are being trained, we're training these students in our different universities and art schools around the world to navigate ambiguity, to be sort of very versatile at connecting the dots, at thinking about divergence and synthesis. And so I would say that in this complexity, yes, methods are difficult to deploy, but this becomes almost like second nature in the kind of education we're giving people, right? And the trick to me is, you know, how do you make sure that you are educating students who are aware of that power they have? Because often we don't focus on that. So like in the program I teach at Parsons on strategic design and management, this is really part of our curriculum, right? We are talking to graduate students who are coming in with an intention to work around complexity and who are hungry and demanding to have access to these tools and to be able, very importantly, to articulate the agency and power of the tools they're learning with us.
Oh, wonderful. So very far developed program, evidently. But can we say that the discipline of design in itself is an agent of change? You just touched this point before, but I think that I would like to ask this directly. Can the discipline of design in itself be an agent of change?
I believe so, right? And of course, you know, there's a long trajectory of amazing sort of scholars and academics that have been saying this from the beginning. And Herb Simon, you know, who has probably had one of the big impacts of bridging design and social science as a Nobel laureate, you know, his definition of design is really the power of designers to develop alternative alternative futures to make change. So for sure, I believe this is part of the modus operandi of the designer. We have makers, we have people that also think through making, and the very act of creation, right, of creativity, of making, is an act that can be hopefully directed to making society's capacity to act or enhance it, which is one of also the definitions of social innovation.
We, in the beginning of our conversation, we touched the topic of diplomacy, and you just said, I'm very sad, the fact that your father just passed away. He was a diplomat.
Yes.
And in our preparatory conversation some month ago, you told me that you attended 14 schools.
Yes.
Due to the fact that your parents were diplomats.
Yes.
You became a global citizen by nature. So tell me something about that, about this kind of experience.
Yes, you know, it was very moving to be around my father at the end of his life and be part of tributes that happened in Argentina when he passed. He was someone who served his country for 50 years as a career diplomat and was in part of the Falklands, Malvinas sort of conflict and war and Palestine and Israeli conflicts and always negotiating to find a middle ground. And my upbringing, really seeing his work up close, but also being sort of in the corridors of the UN, both in New York and Geneva, where he was posted at different times when I was growing up, was definitely very influential. I didn't study international development or foreign policy, but it's one of my big sort of passions, I would say, outside the arts and design. Growing up in that context, first of all, I think it just made that world second nature. So, you know, then becoming an ethnographer when I was doing my PhD for a year within the innovation team at UNICEF, it just gives you a sense of you know the language and you understand a little bit more how this work happens in terms of international development and foreign policy and the very careful and patient work that needs to happen around policy development and the power of policies to move the needle, right? When you have, and this is, I think, one of the great powers and work and effects we're seeing in the evolution of social innovation and social design is how designers increasingly are part of policy teams. And this happens a lot in Europe and in other, more than in the US and in other parts of the world where we have, robust funding coming from the public sector and where designers start being very involved in these projects that have a policy goal. And through policy, you can have tools to see change happen in society in ways that when they're not formalized, you simply can't. But back to your question, I'm being a little long-winded, moving and relocating so many times. You know, I was always the new kid on the block, as we say in the US, right? I was arriving into school systems in the middle of the year sometimes. I had to make friends. I had to sort of, there was this like survival mechanism for my brother and I that, you had to learn a new language sometimes. You had to, you had to make new friends where there were already friends made in a classroom. And that has made me very curious, and very flexible and empathic, I would say, to sort of respecting other cultures and other viewpoints. And I take a lot of I have a lot of sort of a sense of great gratitude for that upbringing because it's defined my practice and my research.
Let's talk a little bit about your work for Cumulus.
Yes.
And also Alto, which over the years, where in both contexts, you have shaped these institutional contexts in a, I think, decisive way.
Thank you. Well, they're really very different. And, you know, there is this coincidence that, of course, the Cumulus Association was born as a project of Alto, but my roles are very separate. And the work that I, the service I have now as one of the trustees, board members of Alto University has only started 2 months ago. I was elected last year as one of the new board members, and I joined the board of Alto University formally in January of this year, 2022. So I have a lot still to learn and contribute, but I'm very, very excited. Alto University really is an incredible success story, right? Three universities from three of the best universities in Finland coming together into this new university vision 10 years or so ago, and really putting radical creativity at the center of one of the priorities, strategic priorities of this university. So it's really an honor to be serving in that board for me, also because it is a university that recognizes the importance of the global in its pedagogy, in its faculty ranks, in its student ranks. And then it's just very, very committed to questions of social change. So that's Alto. And that's, you know, again, very, very new role and that I'm extremely excited about and honored by. The Cumulus Association is an association that, again, was born out of one of before Alto was created really or came into being from TAIC, the former art and design school that became now is one of the six colleges of Alto. And it's an association that has, you know, that has this mandate of bridging through conferences mostly, art and design, education and research, and creating opportunities in the last 30 years since the Berlin Wall came down to bring designers and design academics together to share mobility projects, to look at different themes. The next conference of Cumulus is in Detroit, for example, and it's really focused on climate change and the climate crisis and climate apartheid. And that's a conference being organized by one of the members of Cumulus. There's 350 art and design media universities and colleges that are members of Cumulus, and CCS, one of our great colleges of design in the United States, is hosting and organizing that conference. At Cumulus, I've been serving Cumulus for 9 years as a volunteer, 6 years on boards of Cumulus, and now concluding my service as president of Cumulus in next June. There, it's been a lot of work with my colleagues on the board in the last 3 years because we came into this board period under my presidency of an association that is in a moment of radical transformation. A lot of the work for our members was focused on these in-person conferences. And of course, with the pandemic, everything went online. And so we've been doing a lot of work transforming slowly the association to be, to have the tools to really be global and serve its 350 members. And that means a digital transformation for the association and thinking hard about questions of internationalism in a very disrupted landscape, I would say.
So before we get to our final question about what is good, I would like to make a little step back to the book, because on the cover, yes, of the cover of the book, you have put 45 terms, and which I find incredibly fascinating. And I've made a choice of 10 of them, and I just like would like to read them. And you say stop when you get a term which you would like to give us a closer look at
by
the
fun.
End of this conversation. So as the first term that you have there, this is a selection of the 45 terms, obviously, is advocating.
Yes, stop. I love that term. I find that, you know, it connects a lot to what I do as a senior administrator in my university, as an academic, as someone who bridges ideas and people. Advocating to me is a lot about, you know, creating messages, amplifying the work of others, and making sure that you're helping create messages that reach people and move them into action.
So then, two more. So I continue. The next one would be confronting. The next one would be destigmatizing. The next one would be envisioning.
Yes. So we can talk about this. Yeah, this is an important term in these times in design, in a lot of design discourse and design research, because it really connects to conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion and social justice. These are, you know, conversations that are very, very necessary and often not been dealt with the deepness of thought and action that I believe we need to address them in design. And we're seeing in my institution, again, at Parsons in the US, but in all of the circles I'm part of, nationally in the United States, when it comes to design education, a real exciting work. And this is also part, it's touched upon a little bit in our book, questions of decolonizing design, questions of thinking about, you know, diversity in a very hard way. Who are the designers who get to, you know, that we're championing, who get to access our education in the United States? We have the problem of a very tuition-based high ticket price to access some of our best schools. So this word is really important in that regard.
Okay. One last term. So I continue with this little choice. It would be one term that you selected there was envisioning, another one facilitating, and which I really like very much is futuring. Maybe if I can pick this and ask you what do you mean with future? It's a wonderful word.
So thank you.
Futuring.
Yeah, I have colleagues and contributors in the book who could talk much more eloquently about futuring. One of them is Stuart Candy, who's in the book, who's a design futures expert, who's associated with the School of Design at Carnegie Mellon. And there is, of course, a whole the field of design futures. And there are the importance I would emphasize is on the plural S, right? We want to really start creating conditions and prototypes and scenarios for more than one future. So futuring, I think, sort of signals the anticipatory work that we do in design for social innovation.
Well, thank you very much for these definitions. You would be a very good encyclopedist, like like Diderot and D'Alembert in their time. You could write an encyclopedia on social design yourself. So the last question would be, which is our, let's say, usual question here, this open question. What is good?
Yes, you know, I think to me, sort of, it resonates with questions of ethics and morale, and they're tricky because what is good for one person might not be good for another. So when I think about good, I think about a relational dimension of good, and a tricky negotiation that has to be happening all the time. So it's I think a tricky question because it can also be an invitation to a lot of dogmatism and abuse sometimes. You know, we see a lot of people hiding behind doing good when they are not doing good. So I have a slightly sort of negative answer for you on what is good.
This is the answer that you give. So everyone gives their answers. We had an answer like apricot marmalade is good. And we had very philosophical answers. This is very impressive, I think, answer, because you include the negative, which must always be included in any answer, in order not to be too naive.
That's right.
So thank you very much for the conversation. It was a pleasure for me to have you here in this remote studio.
Well, thank you. I am delighted to be talking to you. And it's a great way to start my day here in New York, my work day at Parsons.
So have a very good day. Have a very good week.
Yes.
And hopefully we see each other in the future.
Thank you for having me in your program.
Das war Georg im Gespräch mit Mariana Amatullo, von der wir erfahren haben, wie wichtig es ist, nachweisen zu können, welchen Impact Social Design hat. Nicht zuletzt deshalb, weil wir viel mehr Mittel und politischen Einfluss brauchen, um mit Social Design so wirksam werden zu können. Unser Programm ist diese Woche aus terminlichen Gründen etwas aus den Fugen geraten. Den ursprünglich für diese Ausgabe vorgesehenen Beitrag mit Professor Dr. Gesche Joost werden wir schnellstmöglich nachholen. Und da wir diesen Termin noch nicht genau kennen, bitten wir um euer Verständnis, dass wir noch keine Ankündigung machen können. Wir halten euch auf jeden Fall informiert und eines bleibt auf jeden Fall sicher. Die nächste Folge kommt bestimmt und ist wie immer für die Abonnenten bereits ab Sonntag nächster Woche abrufbar. Wir wünschen, auch wenn es angesichts des schweren Krieges in der Ukraine fast unmöglich erscheint, allen Menschen ein friedliches Osterfest. Eure DDcast-Redaktion.